Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hey everybody, this is Amuse News. I'm your host, RJ. I am coming to you live from Roberto's in Brooklyn. This is the birthplace of HRN, so I'm happy to be here in the very studio where this organization was created. Today I'm going to be having a conversation with Elizabeth Fisher, who's a research and radio intern and one of our educators for our high school program, so stick around for that. As you probably know if you listen, I wanted to tell you a little bit about some stories that I'm following, and then I'm going to bring Elizabeth in to have a quick conversation. So on Friday, I was invited to a dinner at the home of Ari Miller and Kiki Araneta, who are two chefs in Philly. This was put on by the Marine Stewardship Council, and they're doing an Earth Day and Earth Month initiative. First of all, I had a five-course sustainable seafood dinner that was amazing. But the Marine Stewardship Council created the Blue Fish Label, and the idea is that it helps people easily find seafood that meets the standards for sustainable fishing. You can look for this blue label. It means that the fisheries are certified and required that they meet specific standards in sustainable sourcing, harvesting seafood, and effective fisheries management practices. But most importantly, they're just trying to raise awareness of people eating more sustainable seafood. So you should check them out at msc.org. They're doing events all over the country and a really cool organization. And I appreciated being part of a very delicious meal. There was something from Ambrook that I saw that I thought was interesting. I clicked on it because the title was The Fight for Dairy Diversity in Public Schools. So in LA, where our guest is from.
From San Diego.
San Diego.
Yeah, outside Temecula, outside of San Diego.
We just broke the fourth wall. Sorry. an LA area student sued her school district over the kind of milk that was in the that was available in the cafeteria, which is interesting. But the issue is growing. The USDA, which is obviously the arbiter of school nutrition, they continue to enforce a strict national standard that mandate cow-based dairy be served at lunch, and that schools shall not directly or indirectly restrict the sale or marketing of fluid milk products by the school at any time or any place, which is interesting. So this story I thought was really interesting because there's a student who's continuing to push this organization's lawsuit, hoping that it lands in federal court and hoping that they can get some more diversity in terms of, you know, the milk products in the school. And it's just sort of like USDA's relationship with the dairy industry and promoting this very specific kind of milk. And of course, the lawsuit stating that we're putting the promotion of milk over student well-being, which I just think is a really interesting topic and kind of maybe where the future is heading in terms of how schools, I think school food and what people eat and drink at school was so standardized over the course of the last, 75 years. And now it's starting to be pushed in different directions. So I think that's a really interesting story that, that I'm following. I don't know, Elizabeth, if you drink coffee, but coffee drinking has hit a record high. 67% of adults in the U.S. said they had coffee in the past day, according to the National Coffee Association survey, more than a 20-year high. I'm among that 67%, but I don't know. Are you?
I absolutely am among the 67%. I can't imagine a day without at least two coffees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coffee is part of my day and apparently the majority of Americans' days, but 20-year high is sort of interesting. I don't know what the driving factors are behind that, but I don't know if people are just feeling more tired and needing more coffee, or is coffee getting more delicious? I don't know.
I think it is getting more delicious. It's also getting more expensive, so people are spending more money on coffee too.
That's true. Well, check out this, and all this links for all these stories will be in the show notes, of course, as usual, but I think it's great. I think coffee's great. I don't buy the hype about the danger of coffee. Although you should probably be moderate.
I think, yeah, probably moderation is key with everything. I mean, I think also, I don't know if this contributes to it, but it comes to mind for me. Espresso martinis are having a moment. Oh, they've been having true. A moment. So,
you think that counts?
I think it counts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it counts.
I wonder how many of that 67% are coffee martinis. I do see a lot of coffee martinis in people's pictures.
Yeah, they're very Instagrammable, that is for sure. And people want you to know that they're having an espresso martini when they're having one.
I never have them because I don't drink coffee. Like, I only drink coffee in the morning. And I think having an espresso martini, like, doesn't that keep you up all night?
Yeah, they're not my favorite. They're just, like, a little bit too sweet in general for me. But I get the charm. They do keep you up all night. I think that's part of it. You're gonna go out and you're gonna stay up all night. Yeah.
It's like a, I guess it's a classier version of like a Red Bull and vodka.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to do tequila and yerba mate. That's a fun one. It's not as sweet. And it does the same trick.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so we are having a guest with our news today, obviously. thank you, Elizabeth. The other thing I wanted to mention, I was reading an article. We think about this a lot, my wife and I as parents, but from Food & Wine about how to mitigate your exposure to these forever chemicals in food. We're reading about how these PFAS chemicals are basically everywhere and forever, as the name implies. But this article in Food & Wine brings a couple people in to talk about how you can kind of mitigate against that. I guess, you know, it's doing a lot of research, obviously, but there's sports drinks, processed meats, chips, bottled water, seafoods, freshwater fish, and those are just like some categories that contain these forever chemicals. And I think they're, you know, the industry is trying to do a better job of tracking them, but it seems really hard to keep them like out of your system completely. And I don't know how to do it, but this article gives some guidance, which I think is helpful because it does seem weird that we are like partially plastic at this point.
Yeah, and that half of the ingredients, like not half, but there's a lot of ingredients that, you know, don't need to be named when they go into products. So it's like, what, you know, sometimes it's like, what is the point of an ingredient list if some things just don't need to be listed?
Yeah, it's scary, but you know, whatever. There's a lot of scary things happening. But check out this article by Food & Wine. You might learn how to better track some of this stuff and how to try to mitigate some of your exposure. Okay, a few new HRN episodes I want to tell you about. Culture and Flavor, hosted by Zella Palmer. She is talking this week with Clancy Miller, who's the author of For the Culture, Phenomenal Black Women and Femmes in Food, which is a really cool conversation. This is I think Zella's second episode of this season. She has a bunch more interviews coming out, but you can check that out and subscribe in the show notes or wherever you get podcasts. Beer Sessions, they recently did an episode here where we are sitting, celebrating 10 years of Transmitter Brewing, a really, really cool brewery based here in New York City. And Snacky Tunes has a new episode with an interview with Jess Damock, the author of a book called Health Nut. So I want to just tell you about a few new episodes, and there are going to be more new episodes of Meat and Three very soon.
Yeah, hopefully within the next week. I think that's the plan.
That is the plan. Okay, so Elizabeth, you've already heard from her, but I'll tell you a little bit about Elizabeth, and Elizabeth, you can tell me if this bio is wrong or not, but you were born and raised in Southern California, which was accurate. I just thought it was LA. And
yeah, I mean, I'm actually also not, I'm from Temecula. I just say San Diego. It sounds a little bit more glamorous than Temecula, but it's a suburb outside of San Diego. Yeah.
So you moved to New York City to study journalism and design and food studies at the New School?
Correct. Yeah.
And since then you've been working on, well, at the New School, you worked on a podcast.
I was an intern for an organization called Diversify Your Narrative, and it was a student-run organization, and it was about getting anti-racist text into schools and just diversifying the narrative of both English, science history, and just kind of how we learn in public schools and in colleges. So I was a radio intern for that organization while in school, but it wasn't associated with the New School. It was outside of it.
Got it. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is that you are an intern at HRN, but you're also leading an internship program of sorts for high school students. So I want to talk to you about that. But I think you've been involved with food systems storytelling and the service industry since you moved here, but also before that, right?
Food has always been something that I've been interested in my entire life, cooking and just food media. I started working in the service industry once I moved to New York City, and I worked through school and then after college. So before moving here, it was really just like based off of interest and getting involved in like my local farmer's market and cooking. I wasn't ever like involved in a food system to the extent that I am now, other than being a consumer and someone in love with food.
So I guess my first question, just how has this been being both part of an internship and working with a group of high school students as interns? How have those experiences overlapped, and have you been able to like bring things from one to the other? And how have you kind of balanced that being part of these two groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think being a part of the internship program, which has been highly educational at HRN for myself, around just audio production and how shows here at HRN are made, has helped inform me in terms of how I want to talk to the students about creating audio stories, especially food-related audio stories. So kind of doing the two programs at the same time has gone hand in hand in a way. Also, just being under the umbrella of HRN has been helpful, because my peers in the internship, you know, I'll do check-ins with them and they know I'm teaching students. So I'll tell them, yeah, like all the students showed up this week. So it was a win. And vice versa, I've also shared some projects that I've worked on with the internship with my students as like examples of sort of what they're working on in building audio stories for Pass the Spatula, which is the magazine that they're working on, and they'll have a podcasting component to go along with it.
Yeah, so what has that been like working with high school students? Because it's sort of a program that you do after school, right? And what are they learning and what are you observing them learning, and like are they taking away the same things that you thought they would, and are you seeing their storytelling sort of skills develop as you're kind of going through this program?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've only worked with middle school students prior to this, so going in I was a bit anxious, honestly, to like, I didn't know how it was going to be in comparison, and differences, I'm not sure if there are many other than, you know, maturity, which makes a lot of sense. But in terms of what they're taking away from the program, they're doing interviews right now, and I think understandably so, a lot of them, I mean, they didn't say that they were anxious to do these interviews, but I, you know, wanted to prepare them as much as I possibly could around interviewing the chefs that they're going to talk to, who are really big names in the culinary landscape. So I think they've really leaned into kind of advice that I've given, as well as advice that I've gotten from, you know, my internship that I've passed on to them around doing the interviews and, you know, how to even set up the recording equipment or like the virtual recording equipment to preparing questions. They all seem to be really engaged in understanding how to do that and getting those skills. I think, yeah, it's still a little bit like early in the process. I'm curious to how much they'll be interested or engaged in the actual building of the audio story, the more technical components, but we're not quite there yet. I feel like in terms of storytelling, they're always fresh with ideas. In terms of creating an angle for a story, that's still something that I, and I feel like my peers in the internship and anyone who I took classes with in journalism school struggled with, was really coming up with an angle once you have an idea for a story. So I find that they have kind of they struggle with that too, but we've been talking about that too, is coming up with like a story angle rather than just a story overarching idea.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I should have said this earlier, but as part of what we're doing with HRN, as we grow and evolve, we're trying to create more opportunities to bring high school students, college students, post-college students in through these programs, and kind of create a little bit more of a storytelling academy, as we've been referring to it, and just getting more people to utilize their voices to tell food stories. So that's part of what we're doing here at HRN, and we're going to continue to do that. Elizabeth, what have you learned so far in the internship program? Because you came to it from having worked on a podcast, having worked in food. Like, what have you learned that maybe you didn't expect to learn, or something that you, that was unexpected?
I mean, I will say the biggest thing that I learned that wasn't necessarily unexpected, but I can edit an audio story now. I can use Reaper, which during school, whenever I had to do that, I would just rely on my friends to do it for me, because just even looking at the interface or the software would stress me out. But now I mean, and even in doing the trainings with Matt Patterson, like, it was fun. I had a good time doing it. So that's nice. Something I feel like I can like a huge thing that it was expected. It was what something that I like pushed myself and wanted to learn, but also a huge takeaway so far. Unexpected, I mean, now that we're getting into production and we're pitching story ideas, I have been working on a story about biotech, which is not my field. That was never something that I like really was interested when I studied food studies. So I've kind of like leaned into learning a lot about that. So I've learned some interesting things in terms of new technologies that are coming about in food science and biotech.
That's really cool. I think one of the things that I've been learning over the past 6 months since I joined is like just how to explain what these internship programs are. And I think the thing that makes it really unique is these, like, it's really experiential. Like, we just kind of throw people into it, and you have to, like you were describing, you have to kind of like actually figure it out. And it seems like, to me, that's a unique aspect of this. It's not like sit here and we're going to like tell you how to make a podcast. It's like, here, make a podcast, and here are the tools and kind of education related to how to do it. But then it's up to you to figure out.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And but there's also like such a great support network in terms of like, if you have questions, they will be answered. But that's also like it's just really encouraging to just know that you can ask questions and there's no like intimidation around that. I feel like that is sometimes like, you know, a big hinder in learning anything is like being afraid to ask. That's definitely not the environment. So, yeah.
Nice. You were talking about with the high school kids, having them think about a specific angle for a story as opposed to just, I'm going to tell a story about X. But like, how has that, how have you been helping them move along with like just being more sophisticated about storytelling? Are you using like the story to like the hero's journey kind of formats, or is it really just like asking more questions to push them deeper?
Yeah, we started with the idea of like a story map, and that was more like a general, kind of like a general get to know how you would build your story or what you think you want it to look like. I really tried to emphasize in like that moment in time when we were thinking just about the ideas behind our stories is like, not everything on your story map that you're going to create is going to end up in the final story. Like, it's okay to like be creative and include things that like don't actually end up in the final cut. But then I think like starting broad and really narrowing down. So like now we're at the point where we're doing interviews, and we were brainstorming interview questions the other day, and it was, okay, like how can we funnel these interview questions from like kind of broad, get to know you, what chefs are you talking to more specific, like how are you using food scraps is the theme of the magazine. So how are you using food scraps in your cooking, to more specific is the recipe that the chefs are sharing with the students. How can we ask questions about the recipe and how it relates to the chef's background and the culture? So going from like a very broad topic and all the ideas circulating around that to like the most specific question that you could ask the chef about the most specific thing that they're sharing with you, and allowing space for all of that, but knowing that not everything's going to be included in the story. That's sort of the idea that I've been trying to communicate to the students, whether it's like tell them that actually, or just like how we've kind of formulated our discussions and our question asking.
I wanted to ask a question about like the mindset of, I guess this high school group is, they're very specific in that they're food focused people already, but I have this sense that young people now, as compared to when I was a teenager, like have more interest in, this is a broad generalization, but have more interest in like where their food comes from and how the food is prepared and how it's made. Like, do you see a difference between like the high school students you're working with and like your own peers or people older than you in terms of like wanting to be part of these stories that are like very in depth about where food comes from and how we're treating food as it relates to climate and sustainability and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of our discussions with this group has circulated around food waste just because of the topic of the magazine that they're creating right now, which I think goes along with, like, I think a lot more people are caring about where their food is coming from and then also how their food waste affects the planet. And that's specific to these students, of course, but then also people and peers in general. I mean, there's a lot of, like, apps that are, like, being created to navigate that. So I think there's a lot more, like, awareness around that and how that relates to larger issues of like climate change and just food waste and those more general things. I think with these students, yeah, there's certainly like a heightened level of awareness around food. They go to Food and Finance High School, and they're involved in a lot of different internship programs around food and work in different restaurants in the city and do a lot of activities in regards to that. But their relationship to food, I mean, I can't speak to any one student specifically, but I know they will talk about, like, their school lunches are still the same school lunches that you would get at another public high school, and it's not always the best food. In fact, usually it's not great food. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if that answers that question, but, like, there is certainly, like, a heightened level of awareness and desire to be involved in food systems, but then also, like, they are also just high school kids eating school public lunches. So it's like, yeah, but I feel like that's probably true for a lot of, like, people in, like, the food industry and food storytelling is you are deeply involved in food systems, but they also, at the end of the day, like, you're also just a consumer of food, like, like, have a relationship to food like everyone else. So
and it, when you talk about that, like, the cool thing about food storytelling is that we all consume food, like, every person has a connection to food in some way. But I think these, like, you know, food system stories that we tell at HRN, and I think it sounds like you're working on with the high school students, it's, on one hand, like, it seems simple, like, we all have a relationship to food, but on the other hand, like, our food system is so complex and touches really every issue. How, I guess the first question is just, like, what's the hardest thing about telling food-related stories, in your opinion? Because I'm, like I said, I think what we mostly hear about is, like, there's celebrity chefs and there's, like, cooking shows and there's, like, there are ways that really, I think, connect very immediately with people on a food basis. But then we're trying to tell these, like, much more complicated stories about how food and climate and food and energy and food and migration and these things, like, are all related. Like, what's the hardest part of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, what you had just said about how food is really, like, it intersects with everything, and that's always been something that has both driven me towards food as a topic of interest, because I feel like it's such an interesting lens to learn so many different things about ourselves, about this world, about different cultures and communities. I think one of the biggest challenges, especially, like, at when you're it's knowing your audience to an extent, because I do think that people who are involved in the food industry and the food world have an appreciation and understanding for that. So that's not something that you necessarily, like, have to get across to them, as food is important for all of these reasons. I feel like for me, and this is something that I've sort of, like, overcome, I think, in just knowing myself better, caring about food more, and just, like, kind of going along with that and carrying that as something that's important to me. But for a while, like, I when I went to school, I didn't have any friends who were necessarily in the food studies program. Like, all of my friends are involved in music or literary studies or fashion, which are all things that, you know, those are fun to me, but my central focus was food. So it was really, like, explaining to them why this was important to me. Like, I always felt like I had to justify it. And I do think that that's sort of, like, when you're telling a food story, or when you're telling a food story, that's not, when food is really just a lens to tell a larger story, and you have someone who doesn't, like, appreciate necessarily that from the get, it can be kind of a challenge in that way. So it's, I feel like, knowing your audience, of, are you telling the story to people who already appreciate food as a way to learn about more things, or are you telling the story to someone who's, like, really not coming to food from that angle? I also think, in terms of telling food stories, just sort of, like, choice of language is always something that I really try to think about often, because I think a lot of times, like, the words that we use in food stories can be exclusionary sometimes, or can, like, leave people out if they don't know certain terms, but also you can't always spend a lot of time, like, defining certain terms and telling food stories. And then just in general, like, we're doing some work right now on the notion of authenticity in Meat and Three. And it's also just asking yourself, like, what does that mean? And how can that term, like, maybe, yeah, leave people out? Or, like, what, really investigating what certain terms mean, because I think that is also really important. Mm-hmm.
What are like a couple of the most intriguing food stories that you're following or thinking about right now?
Yeah, I think I really have done a deep dive in some, like, food science biotech work just based off of the story that I'm creating for Meat and Three right now. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with CRISPR technology. It kind of lines up with It's in the same world or realm as GMOs. They're different in terms of how they work, and actually, like, using CRISPR technology is a lot cheaper than using GMOs. So I think it's something that we're going to see come into our food system soon. Right now, I guess it's only really being used on mustard greens in California. That's where you can find it in the marketplace to make mustard greens less bitter. But it's basically, yeah, it's modifying food. And that's something that I've been learning about through specifically a researcher, Dr. Lauren Crossland Marr. She created a podcast series that's really, really great. It's called A CRISPR Bite, and it goes into detail about what this CRISPR technology is and how it's being used, not necessarily to help with issues and solutions around climate change, which is sometimes how it's branded, but more so to bolster kind of industrial agriculture, as you would maybe guess. So that's something that I've been really interested in, and I've been talking to some interns who are more like food science-y about than I am, but so that's where my brain's been at. Otherwise, I am always following like new restaurants in New York. That's something that is always exciting for me, just for personal reasons of like where I want to go eat next. So,
yeah, and we talked to the owner, one of the owners of Roberta's, Brandon, who has two restaurants in the top like 55 or whatever on the New York Times list. So there's two.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah. No. Oh, of course. I love the list. I'm always like looking through this list. I have like a list of my own, but I pull from all the different lists.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So you're the other part of your work is in the service industry. So it's like spring in New York. There's like the chairs and tables are getting put out on the sidewalk, and it seems like the city's coming to life in a different way than it was a couple months ago. What are you thinking about from that side?
I mean, both like, as someone who lives in New York who can't wait to go sit out on a patio and hang out with my friends and eat oysters, like, I'm excited about that. But from someone working in the industry, it's always encouraging to know that it's patio season, restaurants are hiring, and they're going to get busier. I've had different experiences working in summers in New York. I've had really busy summers, but I've also worked at a very like neighborhoody spot where the neighborhood leaves for the summer. So if you're working in the city, it's a very different experience than working in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, because, you know, if people are going to leave for the summer to go do whatever they do during the summer, you lose a large percent of your customer base. So it's not always a promising sign that summer is coming in terms of what sales are going to look like. But it's kind of always a toss-up. I feel like working in restaurants is like you really never know what to expect. You can predict based off of last year and what things are looking like. But from like even from like a week to week, from like a day to day, you don't know what your covers are going to be one night to another unless you're consistently a busy restaurant. So we will see what the summer looks like in New York. Hopefully all good things. I'm excited for it.
Nice. Yeah, it's crazy to see the turnover like in Philly where I live or here. Like there's so many new restaurants opening all the time and then restaurants closing. Like it feels like there's a ton of turnover. Maybe I'm just paying closer attention now, but it feels like post-COVID, maybe there's even more turnover than there was before. I don't know. But I feel like there's so many new restaurants, but you also hear about so many restaurants that are closing or that are downsizing or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about like pre-COVID, post-COVID. I really started working in restaurants like during COVID and post-COVID, so I wouldn't necessarily be able to do a compare and contrast. But I do think that that's true for at least New York restaurants. There's always turnover, and it's, you know, it's always surprising to like see a really amazing restaurant close. But then there's always like a really amazing restaurant to take its place. So. You kind of can't like get too attached to your favorite restaurants, which is sad to say, but it's exciting place to eat out because there's always new stuff happening.
Okay. Last two questions. What was your last best bite?
Oh my God. On Sunday I worked at a restaurant that I helped open about, or I was like part of the opening team, two years ago. It's a neighborhood cafe in East Williamsburg called Good Thanks. And we had family meal on Sunday night, and the line cook made fried ice cream, which I don't think I've had since I was like 8 years old.
Awesome.
And I want to say it was like on a bed. A bed doesn't feel like the right word, but of like a bed of pie crust and coconut whipped cream And it was so big, and I was like, oh my God, like, I'm not going to be able to finish this. And of course I ate the entire thing. But I think that like goes down in history as like the coolest family meal I've ever had. Fried ice cream. I'm not sure like how that came to be or like how that was, like what the inspiration was for that. But I wasn't mad about it. It was fun.
Was it like rolled in like, a, like did the crust have like coconut?
No, the crust was just flour. Okay. And it's always funny when they're making family meal, cause it's like, that's not something on our menu. Like, what are you doing? But I didn't realize it was balls of ice cream being rolled in egg wash and then flour. But then it was a coconut whipped cream and then caramelized bananas. So it was so good.
I remember having that as a kid, and it's a really cool thing that I don't see very often.
Just the notion of fried ice cream is crazy.
Do you have a favorite current recipe? That's the last question.
I mean, I love cooking. My, like, living situation right now, like, I don't cook that much. I also eat a lot of times at work. So I haven't been like following recipes too often. I will say that I love like a nice, I mean, I love pasta in general, but I would say I would choose like a bright summery pasta over like a heartier red sauce pasta. Mm-hmm. So now that summer is coming, I was thinking of some of my favorite pasta recipes. There's a New York Times cooking app, which I love. There's a recipe with like a, it's like summer squash and eggplant and like a feta based sauce and with like lots of dill. One of my favorite pasta recipes ever because it's very unexpected. It's like a, I don't want to compare it to Alfredo, but it is like a feta cheese sauce, like really salty, really bright flavors. So I'll probably try to make that despite my lack of cooking lately. I'll make that soon.
Awesome. Well, that sounds delicious. I hope it works. Well, thank you, Elizabeth. This has been really fun. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
And if you like what you hear, of course, subscribe, follow us on social, leave reviews, and share with all your friends. I'm going to be back tomorrow with a conversation with someone who is putting on the Queer Food Conference, which is coming up at the end of this week. So tune in for that. And thanks for listening. Thanks again, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Yep. Cool.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.